I'm Kevin Middleton.
And I'm Samantha Berg. And this is The Bridge to Everywhere. Welcome to The Bridge to Everywhere, a holistic exploration of individual health, community, and culture. The topics we'll be discussing on this show will address health for informational purposes only and is not intended as medical advice. If you have a medical condition, please consult an appropriate care provider.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining us on The Bridge to Everywhere. I'm Kevin Middleton, and I'm here in the studio with Samantha Berg. And today we're going to be talking with Father Christopher Stanton. And before we begin, I just want to introduce our program as a holistic exploration into individual health, community, and culture. And we want to take a look at how all three of these are interwoven and interdependent. And as we explore these topics, we really invite you to stay in touch with us, and you can communicate with us on Facebook and let us know your thoughts and any questions.
Hi, everyone. I'm Samantha Berg, and I want to introduce Father Christopher Stanton to you all. So Father Christopher has done several talks in our office, and he is a Russian Orthodox priest and a mental health and addictions chaplain. He's been practicing both for the last 14 years, and the last six of which have been spent leading spirituality workshops and offering individual counseling and anchorage on topics including building a healthier self-relationship, addictions recovery, grief and loss, and depression. He's just moved his practice to the Valley, and we're really excited to have him here. And he's actually lived in the Valley for the past 8 years. He's a husband and father of six, and he has two cats and 20 chickens, and all the chickens are named Lily. So welcome, Father Christopher. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Sal. Good to be here with you both.
Great to have you.
So what we wanted to do is explore the subject of transitions during the season. And a lot of our patients in our work as acupuncturists, we see some difficulty in that movement between winter and spring. Now, we're going to look at that in depth, and we want to really tap into your expertise working with people through the difficulties of depression and other life challenges that happen. But before we do that, it would be really great to hear a little bit about your background and where you're from and the work you've been doing, and now this transition. I understand you're going to be practicing out here in the Valley.
That's right, Kevin. Thank you. My background is quite varied. I come from Los Angeles, California originally, through Seattle areas as growing up, back down to California for college, out to Pennsylvania for seminary, Colorado for First Parish. Ordination through that process. Through the whole process, as I've been moving along in my journey, seeing the need and necessity of a sense of spiritual growth, spiritual attainment. One of the things I learned very early on in my spiritual journey, come Lent, as we're experiencing right now for many of us, we all want to reach spiritual works. And I went to my spiritual father, And I wanted something good. I wanted something powerful. And he gave me the Brothers Karamazov. I had never heard of the Brothers Karamazov at the time. And I was let down. I wanted something, you know, man's mission with God or something like that. And so it took me two Lents to actually read the book. And when I got through the book, I asked my spiritual father, I said, why? He says, you know, so many people want to increase their spiritual life, but they leave their soul behind. And that sense of the growth and maturity of the soul along with the spirit has to happen, or we become, in a sense, soul sick. And I've seen that in a lot of people that I worked with, is that people have become soul sick. And they're really looking for something spiritually, yes, but something to kind of bolster who they are, to know who they are. I work with adolescents and adults both. Adolescents, they don't know who they are and where they're headed. They're looking at lots of places except for the one place that exists, which is inside of them. And so that's been the growth of my ministry and my work, is the process of trying to increase a healthier relationship with ourself or with our soul. And so that's what brings me here today on your program, and brings me here today in the Valley wanting to see that. I don't see a lot of this work being done and offered to the public, to those who have mental health issues, to those struggling with addictions. And those are kind of my focus. And so that's me in a nutshell.
That's awesome. So it seems like a lot of the time the focus on working with mental health issues is focusing on the biochemistry. You know, assuming that something is off with the person, off with the brain, or that they had some experience that they just weren't able to deal with, and that's the source of their angst. So you're really looking deeper when you're working with people, correct?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. You know, my children are homeschooled, and we collect lots of references for them as they do their schooling and learning. And one of the references, we got the 1824 edition of Noah Webster's Dictionary. And
wow.
I work in the mental health and addictions fields, and so that's a lot of psychology. Well, if you look at a dictionary today, psychology is the study and field of behavior and thoughts. If you look 100 years ago from what we have today, back in 1824, psychology is the study of the soul. And that's really what it is, and that is what we're missing in the field of mental health, is we have lost the soul. Mm-hmm. We've turned to the brain, we've turned to you know, neurology, we've turned to that process of that sense of biology, but we've missed, we are attaining to the material sense of us, but what about that immaterial sense? What about where our character, our personality comes from? And it's fascinating for me to see that dichotomy of just 100 years, 1824 to 19-something, you know, the new edition of dictionaries, to see that change.
Yeah, what we often notice in our treatment room when we're working with people is that they may have an experience where I would say it's kind of like their soul crying out. There's this underneath feeling like something's just not right. But what do they do with that is often they try to make that go away. So they take a antidepressant med, or they find some other addiction to get involved with to make that little voice inside that's sort of gnawing at them go away, because they don't want to feel uncomfortable. But that actually may be some part of them saying, hey, pay attention to me. And so by making that voice go away with a drug or some other addictive behavior like alcohol, or, you know, some people are even addicted to exercise, whatever it is, so they don't listen to that, they're kind of not paying attention to a really important part of them.
It's interesting, yeah. Because in a way what you're describing, it sounds like we're in some cases pathologizing the very mechanism of development that would have us reach deeper and have a more mature and deeper relationship with ourselves, and maybe face into some of those difficult things that are asking to be opened up and explored for deeper healing to happen.
Absolutely. There's two pieces as you're talking that comes to my mind. One is a group that I've done for mental health, for addictions recovery, and it's on regrets. And I asked my group, who do you listen to? And they're pretty honest, because they're having to be honest to get out of their addiction. And they say, well, honestly, I only listen to myself. I said, exactly. You know, that's the truth. You know, somebody could say something wise. I have to agree with it before I'm going to listen to it, of course. So I said, okay, so you listen to yourself. Well, we have a mechanism, and we actually have two things that came to mind. One is a sense of conscience, and the other one is a sense of regret. And regret, when we talk about regret, regret is my inner voice that tells me that was genuine or that wasn't genuine to me. And we don't listen to that. We're trying to drug it away. We're trying to make it go away. We're drowning it. Mm-hmm. We're busying it. We're doing all sorts of things to make me go away. And my own healthy and health-giving capacity to go away. And so we're really losing, in that sense, ourselves. And that's so evident today.
Yeah, we were having a discussion before the radio show a few days ago. I was talking to Father Christopher, and I told him about a recent patient who'd made a comment that she realized that taking Lexapro was just allowing her to be not quite miserable enough so she could deal with the fact that things weren't right in her life. So being on this medication, even though there were some things in her life that she really needed to address, and by taking the Lexapro, it allowed her to not look at those things, and she was still miserable, but she didn't have to change. So she realized it was only when she got off the Lexapro that she was able to see those things and actually address them. And just to back up, I don't want to bash drugs, because there are certainly situations where they're necessary and where they really do help people get through some really tough places in life. It's just that once you've gotten through that experience, or once you've gotten through that part of your life, then you really do have to go back and still do the work to address the issue.
The work, that event, mm-hmm. is still there and will always be there until we begin to, what I call, story ourselves. Those events are our stories. They are our meaning. They are what is real or genuine or intrinsic in our life. And if we push them away, we end up with a hole in our mm-hmm. life. And I would often say, have you ever told a joke and forgot the punchline? What'd you do for the rest of the day? Right? You thought about that punchline, or telling somebody a story and that word wouldn't come off your tongue. Mm. We spend the whole day trying to come up with that word. Sometime in the middle of the night, we wake up and say, indecipherable. The person next to us goes, what? Nothing, never mind. But we don't do well as human beings with holes. Mm. And so when we put these events away from us, don't want to deal with them because they're painful, or we don't know how to deal with them or what to do, we end up with these holes, and our lives become stuck or revolving around these holes. And we really need to begin to address, to fill these holes in with our own truth, with our own reality, and to be able to see what our own stories are in order to embrace our life, which allows us to move on. In our life.
When you said circling around a hole, I'm just sort of imagining somebody going round and round around a drain hole and sort of going slowly towards the bottom. They're just like circling down and circling down and circling down, and they don't know why, but there's just this pull in that direction. And in a way, it's calling them again to face that thing and to deal with it. But their experience is just like, I'm feeling worse, I'm feeling more depressed, as that part of them is calling more to like, hey, pay attention to me.
That's right.
We need to do something about
this.
That's
right. Many people who I've met on a mental health unit, they got there for that reason. That they hit bottom. Mm-hmm. They circled and circled and did whatever they could to keep out of that hole. And finally, there wasn't anything else they could do, and they ended up at the bottom.
And it seems like in that place in life, there's a certain humility that emerges that creates the space to actually look in and actually ask for help, and then begin to construct the kind of life that doesn't have those problems anymore or moves beyond them.
To be able to address the real need.
Yeah.
When we hit bottom, I make the analogy with my car. Hitting bottom is not the end. And what many people think is, I have nothing when I hit bottom. But my car, when the little light that looks like a gas tank comes on, a gas pump that comes on, it doesn't tell me that I'm out of gas. It tells me that I'm low on gas, or that I need gas. Hitting bottom, we're not out of gas. Because if my car's out of gas, the engine dies. And we're still breathing. We haven't
right.
died yet,
right.
you know. But when we hit bottom, it is that light coming on saying that I am running low, that where I'm at is the level of need. What are my needs? How do I identify my needs? And how do I begin to attend to them? Because we can get so lost in our wants. And that's really what gets us there. We get so lost in our wants, you know, in this kind of reality way out there. And we lose touch with ourselves. And in that sense of myself and my needs, those core values.
It's interesting because it does ultimately come back to something so simple, doesn't it?
Sure, absolutely. The universe, in one level, is simple. It's just simplicity. We make it complicated, we as human beings, but we have the ability to simplify, you know, to bring back a sense of innocence, a less complicated mode of life and existence. Absolutely.
It's interesting that you say that, because often when you're an outsider and you're coming in and somebody's talking about their problem to you, and it seems very complicated and very convoluted and all these different, well, I could do this, but this would end up this way, and I could do that. And so as an outsider, sometimes you can see it's like, it's so simple. They just need to do this. But sometimes it's they know that they need to do it, but they don't, there's a part of them that doesn't want to.
Right.
So it can be made. That's one of the reasons, I think, for the complexity is that just in fact, the person even knows what they need to do, but they don't want to do it yet. They're not at that place.
Uh-huh.
So they're making themselves completely miserable because they're not ready to make that change.
Right.
Yeah.
We talk about individual health and we talk about community. And this is really where community comes to play. I can recognize my problems, but because I'm in the midst of those problems, I'm experiencing the stress, the chaos, the pain, the uncertainty, the fear. And all of those things cloud my vision, cloud my judgment, and put me in a little hole and I hide. It is community that allows us to be brought out. A, I'm not alone. You know, that there are other people, and this is why AA works when we talk about it. You know, the medical, you know, establishment talks about addiction as a disease. Well, how is the disease conquered? It's conquered through community. Addictions isolate us, right? Recovery is community. It's that process that we can see that I'm not alone, that I am accepted, I'm not rejected. And you have to find the right community to do that.
Sure.
You know, but it's that process that allows me then to hear something that I need and to allow somebody to help me walk through that process in my life. There's a very familiar and popular poster talking about footsteps, you know, footsteps in the sand. And it talks about that sense of community. When I thought I was alone, I was being carried.
Uh-huh.
And that's our sense of community, that when we feel alone, we need to find those people who can and are willing to help carry us through that process. People give good advice, usually when the problem's not theirs. Because there is no fear, there's no pain, there's no chaos in their life. And so we can see it clearly. You know, that's the process of counseling and chaptaincy. That's the process why you go to the doctor because your elbow hurts and you end up talking his ear off. Because we have that process to be able to say, this is what we need. And we say, wow, they're so wise, simply because they're not the one in the midst of the problem or the issue.
And the other thing about community and family really is that when you're not focused that intensely on your problem, when you're focused on helping someone else, or you're generally going to live up to your highest values, but being part of a community actually asks you to pay attention to the part of yourself that really wants to do what's right, really wants to do the best thing. So sometimes the best thing to do if you're deep down into you're getting close to that hole and circling the bottom might be go work in a soup kitchen.
That's it.
Help somebody less fortunate than yourself, you know, like go volunteer in your community and do something that, because in that process of doing something valuable for the community, you start to value yourself differently.
Absolutely.
It's interesting because our lives are always made better when we're putting our attention on something larger than ourself. It seems to be a fundamental, it's a law of physics, it seems. You can be in a very, you know, grave state of despair or depression, but the moment you see a need, if you see, for instance, somebody falling down on the ground, or, you know, there's an automobile accident, some unfortunate circumstance, where does your depression go? In an instant, it vaporizes, and in most cases, a person would immediately find within themselves a strength that seems to know no bounds and would rise to the occasion. And so there's something about the capacity to see beyond just ourselves. Now, that's not to deny ourselves, but to actually see beyond just the sort of fishbowl reality that most of us inhabit in our thoughts and our fears and our worries and our past, that in community and in a greater sense than just our own isolated selves, we seem to rise to a much higher capacity and potential.
It connects us to really our core self. That depression, I can help the person get up off the ground, I can brush them off, I can see if they need to be attended to, and when that event is over, my depression is going to be there for me, because I haven't done anything with it. What we're really connecting to is that sense, what we see in that situation is, when I reach out of myself to help somebody, I'm dealing with compassion. I'm dealing with respect, I'm dealing with honor, I'm dealing with value of a human being. How often we don't turn those same values back in reflection on ourselves. You know, how am I compassionate with myself? How do I honor myself? How am I, you know, helpful and respectful towards myself as a human being, as I was to this person who tripped on the ground? In that sense, is that process that as I can learn from my surroundings, those things that I need to focus on myself. And Sam, you were mentioning, talking about community, how it allows us to then kind of reach out of ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
But there's that sense from that, that as I learn to do that, what I also gain back is people's reference towards me. So I can say, I'm a good person.
Mm-hmm.
So what? Who knows? I can prove myself wrong. And that's so easy to prove myself wrong. You know, to show all of my faults. There's nobody who knows my faults better than I do. You know, but when I reach out into my community from these core values that are truly me, it is that expansive me that exists within me. That when I reach out from them, if I pay attention and listen, people will reflect back to me their view of me. And I can accept that if I want. You know, people will say, "You're so helpful." And we're so easy to say, "Oh, no, no, it's just what I do." You know, "Oh, no, no," you know, et cetera, et cetera. But if we simply allow ourselves to be in the presence of that compliment, in the presence of that feedback, we can learn a lot about ourselves. Perfectionists have a hard time with this. That a perfectionist has a higher standard. Higher than what? Well, higher than genuine, really.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, it's higher than genuine, and so we can never meet it. But if we listen to people that we work around, that we work for and with, we will begin to hear a real sense of who we are. I started that about a year and a half ago, that I started realizing, getting out of my own selfishness, that people see me differently than I see myself. And so I started going to people who I trusted, colleagues and friends, and I'd ask them, "How do you see me?" And I wanted both. I really wanted to hear the positive, because that's reaffirming of myself and what I do. And I wanted to hear the negative so I could grow from it. But I needed to hear both so I could balance it. And we talk about healthiness, is that really sense of balance. If I'm out of balance, I'm not healthy. You know, if I'm, you know, all about, "I'm such a great guy," there's always growth, you know, and will always be growth. And if I'm the terrible guy over here, well, that's not always true too, because I have that heart and I have that love and that warmth that people experience. And I really have to have that balance. And sometimes reaching into the community gives me that balance.
I think something that you said about wanting to hear the both sides is interesting, because I really do think if you want to change, you really got to want to change. It can't just be like, "I want to change so that my problems will go away." You really have to want to be a different person. And in order to do that, you actually have to listen and pay attention to the truth of what's actually going on. So, and guaranteed, there is a part of you that does want to grow and does want to change. That's what I've experienced working with people over the past 10 years. There is a part of the person. It's just, are they putting their attention there, or are they putting their attention somewhere else?
Right.
You have to be willing to listen and willing to hear and willing to actually deal with what's actually happening right now in this moment and not try to push it away.
That's it. I learned that with my children. I have 6 kids. You know, 5 girls, 1 boy. Poor guy. You know? And with I'm the youngest of 3 in my own family. I didn't grow up with cousins and such like that. They're, you know, either my age or older, but we didn't live near each other. And so small children, infants, are not my thing. And so when we had our first child, I was told, it was a lie, by the way, I was told, "Your life will change." The lie was, my life didn't change. It ended. And a new life began. Because here is this infant who has a total and absolute need of me for its warmth, for her, you know, her warmth and her nurturing and her food and all of these things, that absolute total. And all of a sudden, my life was not mine anymore. And I didn't know what to do. And here I am, struggling, kicking and screaming, going, "No, I had this independent life. I can decide what I wanted to do. I could actually sleep for 8 hours in a stretch, you know," this kind of a thing. We just had our 6th child this last year in October. And my wife mentioned, and hopefully this is not just because I've had my 6th child, but she says, "Oh, you're so different with the infants." See, to them, to me, back 12 years ago, they were this lump. They didn't interact. They just, they were there.
Yeah.
And I love my daughter, and I love all of my children, but just I interact and I laugh and I play with the feet. And that growth, the wanting to change,
mm-hmm.
because life changes us.
Yep.
And we can spend a lot of time running away from where we are.
Exactly.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's just thinking about the very mechanism of change. On one hand, you know, there's a part of us that fears it. But really, who would really want an unchanging life and an unchanging world? Do we really want that? And, you know, would any of us really want to live the same day that we lived 3 days? Even the best memory, the best life experience, would we want to have that day over again, where we know everything that happened, nothing new? There's a newness, a freshness of life itself. And really, I think the best part of us wants that.
Yes. And when we talk about depression, when we talk about suicide, those concepts. Suicide comes, people talk about suicide, it's not a problem. It is a solution. Because we can get you to want to live. But if we haven't done anything about the contributing factors, those problems and situations in our life, we're going to get right back to where we are. And it's that process. If we had to be, why does somebody start thinking about suicide? Because they see no change. Nothing can change, right? I don't see any way out of this situation. I don't see any way out of my plight. You know, I don't see any experience that I can have that's different than what I've been having. And all of a sudden, they're stuck and they become hopeless. Change, we talk about fearing change. If we had no change, we would truly have no hope. Because that sense of hope, that vision for the future, if there's a future, there's change.
Yep, that's really interesting that you bring those two together, because in Chinese medicine we say the same thing. If there is no hope, then there isn't any vision. And vision in Chinese medicine is the aspect of the person that's kind of up and circling around and looking. Even if the person's doing the same thing day after day, working in the same cubicle, you know, seeing the same people, doing the same routines, there's still a part of them that's awake and sort of looking around and seeing what's going to come. I know something good is coming around the corner, and I just have to wait. And maybe it'll take 2 years. Maybe it'll take 2 months, maybe it'll take 20 years, but the person who's operating from that place where they have hope and they have vision, then they're positive, because they know that change is coming, and they're able to contribute on a different level versus the person who doesn't have any hope and it's just the same old thing over and over again, and this is never going to end. There's something that I heard you say in the classes that you've done for us about what you ask people who are in that place where they have no hope that anything is going to change. About what do you, is it your life, is it life that you don't like, or is it your life right now? Could you share that with our listeners?
That's it. You know, I was asked to visit with a gentleman, very suicidal, came into the hospital for help. I was asked to visit with him because they didn't really know what to do with him. You know, and so we had a really good conversation. And listening to his story and listening to the issues in his life and kind of exploring a little bit outside of those issues, you know, when he was younger, what he wants to do when he, you know, grows up sort of idea. I asked him this question because it became a question for me. What do you want to end? Do you want to end your life, the space from, you know, your left hand to your right hand, you know, 4 feet apart? Or do you want to end your life as it is right now, the space from your left hand to your right hand that's maybe only 6 inches apart? And he really gave it serious thought. And his response was, my life as it is now. Because he could remember good times in his past. And if there were good times in the past, there can be good times in the future.
Exactly.
It was where he was right now. And what was interesting is he was able to get some help and go through that process. I had a flat tire about a year later. I was at a conference, and I had a flat tire, and so I call up my road assistants because it was raining and it was cold, and they get paid to do that.
Yep.
You know, and so the van comes around, and this guy gets out, and we look at each other, and it was that guy. And I asked him, I said, how are you doing? He says, fabulous. I'm doing great. And we talked about the change, and we talked about how simply going through the process of attending to those problems was a change itself. Mm. It wasn't that everything in his life changed. Getting help was the change that allowed him to find that hope.
And that's the vision, actually being able to see beyond just that 6 inches between two hands.
Right.
It's beautiful.
Exactly.
You know, I'm reminded of the story of Nelson Mandela, who was in prison for some 30 years. And, you know, talk about vision. I saw a documentary and I saw the cell that he was living in, which it doesn't look like he would even be able to lay down stretched out in the small space. So imagine being in a cramped cell where you can't even stretch out fully. And, you know, whatever kind of labor that was involved daily, very harsh living situation. And this man came out of 30 years of prison and changed a nation. And so talking about being able to hold a vision through the most desperate of circumstances, that's extraordinary. And it just points to the kind of potential that humanity holds.
And you're reminding me now also of one of the books that we talk about in our meditation class is Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning.
Yeah.
And that's a beautiful book. Viktor Frankl was in concentration camps in Nazi Germany. And he was also a doctor. And he found one of the things that he saw was that people who survived, no matter how bad their wounds or their physical injuries or how you know, how starved they were, that there was some meaning in their life. They found some purpose, you know, and that's what connected them to hope and vision, and that's why they made it through that experience.
And that's it. And that brings me to the work that I so love to do, which is Nelson Mandela didn't come out to change a nation. He came out having changed himself. He found value, he found truth, he found reality, he found life, love, and light in himself. And that changed a nation.
Absolutely.
You know, there's a Russian mystic, holy elder, named Seraphim of Sarov, and he says, if you gain the spirit of peace, you will save or convert 1,000 around you. That's the peace, that we gain that spirit of peace, and then that you want it, I want it, the person across the street wants it, and that is the focus of the work that I love to do.
It comes from surrender, though, in a way. When you were talking about the having six kids or having the first kid and being so, you know, this is my life, I don't want to give up my life, but really when you hit that place where your life ended, you surrendered. This is actually not my life anymore.
Right.
And it's such a relief. I mean, I think that if it's not my life, then I don't have to carry around all these ideas, all these hopes, desires, fears, wants, all this little ball of stuff that I just think is me and all this stuff that I have to workshop through. I've got stuff to do. I don't have time for all that.
I don't have to be my own God anymore.
Uh-huh.
And I can let him take care of the rest of it.
It seems interesting because that insight in and of itself is that it comes back to simplicity once again and that desire for peace. And that it's a deep, natural component in us. It's already, it wants to be recognized. It wants to express itself, if only we would let it. And we'll come back in a few minutes and we'll revisit this. We're speaking with Father Christopher Stanton, and you're listening to The Bridge to Everywhere. You're listening to The Bridge to Everywhere with Kevin Middleton and Samantha Berg. Hi, welcome back. You're listening to The Bridge to Everywhere, and we're speaking with Father Christopher Stanton, and we've had a lively discussion about the nature of healing and the phenomenon of depression and the various challenges that we all experience as we go through life together. One of the questions that I wanted to ask you, Father Christopher, is how do you see the balance between truth and compassion? And one of the things that we see in our own work is that on one hand, truth can be incredibly liberating, just to shine the light of truth on a circumstance where a person has been deluding themselves and the very mechanisms of illness have been driving their life. And at the same time, if you give too much truth, it can be harsh. And so without a certain balance of compassion, you may lose the opportunity to be of real help to a person. On the other hand, if you give compassion without truth, then you risk being a collusionary influence. You collude with the very forces, potentially, of illness.
And you might need to just make it clear what when you say collude with the very forces of illness, just spell that out a little bit more so that our listeners can get that.
Well, it could be very easy when someone is suffering to want to make a lot of space for their suffering and to acknowledge it and find yourself aligning with, inadvertently aligning with and reinforcing and enabling that very illness itself.
That's the word that we talk about, is enabling. Is that, you know, if there's too much compassion, and that's a hard thing to say, too much compassion, but there's a sense of enablement, that there is not that truth. You know, Kevin, there's a poem that I use of an Indian poet. His name is Kalidasa. The poem is named Kalidasa. And in that poem, he's talking about the day. He's talking about this is the time right now that we have to embrace our life, to face life, and to go forward into life. It's kind of his process. In there, he makes a statement. There's a line that he talks about the embracing of our verities and realities. And when we talk about that sense of truth, verities being truth, realities, that truth, the way I see it, truth is very personal. What is true to me may not be true to you. What is true in my life may not be something that is true in your life. But there are realities that connect that. And so in a discussion, I can be feeling a certain way. That feeling is true, because that's how I'm feeling. Although you may not want to be or trying to elicit that feeling in me. I may feel hurt. I'm not trying to hurt you. Don't feel hurt. No, I feel hurt. But that's not where I'm trying to get to. That's my truth. But it may not be the reality of the conversation. And I think that's where we begin to pull apart that sense of truth and compassion. That in truth, that is me personally, but I'm not the center of the universe. And so that doesn't, you know, oftentimes we take our truths and we make them broad, and we take a brush and we paint everything with that truth. And that's not always the truth, right? Out here, it's not the reality. But that reality says that I have a truth within myself, you have a truth within yourself, compassion pulls us together. The word compassion, the C-O-M means with. Passion, in today's society, we don't understand that word very well. We think passion is zeal and going for the gusto and all of these. This is a good word. If we look at the ancient understanding of that word passion, it means to suffer. And so compassion is to suffer with. And what we find is, even though I have my truth, it is not the whole story, because I am not the universe unto myself. And so in reality, our truths have to come together and they have to meet, and that we have to take on each other's to really understand each other, that sense of reality, you know, but never lose our own in the process. So if I come to a person who's suffering, oh, woe is me. Yes, absolutely. Woe is you. How awful this is to suffer, how much it hurts, et cetera, et cetera. And yet, is that the whole reality of life itself? No. And to hold the balance, yes, I'm suffering. But is that all life is suffering? And the answer is no. And so many stories come to my mind. Just one to pull out is a quadriplegic, a woman who lost her ability to move her arms and her legs. All she could move was her head. And she was in a nursing home, and a friend came to see her. And this is a friend out of town, had not seen her, and so comes in, and it was really that sense of, oh my gosh, what a pity, I'm so sorry for you, this must be awful, you must be unhappy, how can you live in such a way? And as she comes in, her friend comes into this room, she greets her, and she's kind of surprised that there is life and light and joy in the face of this woman who's lying on this bed. And she says, well, I'm kind of confused, her friend says. Why are you so joyful? You're stuck in this bed, this suffering, this terrible thing. All the things you can't now do. I mean, there's that, you know, terrible syndrome, you go down that road.
Right.
The woman in the bed says, I have all the beautiful things in the world. I know all the beautiful things in the world. And I am all the beautiful things in the world. It is that sense that, yes, I am a quadriplegic. I'm stuck in this bed. But I have friends. I have caregivers. I have this window. I have the look, you know, the view out this window. I have these trees. I have the seasons. I have warmth and I have cold. I have myself. Just because my body doesn't work doesn't mean that I'm not present, and I'm not fully alive, and that I'm not fully engaged in the life that's in front of me. It's that peace that we can take that truth. You're stuck in this bed. You have no use of your arms. You're done. You are no longer a contributor to society in that sense. But there's a compassion that goes with that, that we need to connect to it, that says, yes, that's true. But I am present in the reality that I am a vital part of that society. Society now comes to me, where I used to go to them. You know, and every caregiver who walks in my door, I smile to. Every caregiver that walks in my door sees me simply as a lesson that it could be worse.
Sure.
That's exactly. Often we say.
Actually, I was going to talk about that, because there's a difference between sort of relative truth, which sometimes comes from, you know, the color glasses that you're looking from, the way, you know, are you the optimist kind of person? Is the glass half full, or are you the pessimist? Is the glass half empty? And then there's the objective truth, which is often much larger. It's the bigger picture. And sometimes it takes that kind of perspective, that coming into somebody a lot less fortunate than you are is going to bring to your situation. You say, oh, wow, you know, I actually have it really good. I have, you know, I have two arms and two legs that I can use. This person doesn't have that, you know, and I haven't been appreciating what I do have. One of the stories I like to tell to my clients in the treatment room is something I heard on NPR. It was probably about 3 years ago, and it was a story of a drought going on somewhere in Africa, and it was a story about, you know, hundreds of thousands of livestock dying and families just trying to save their animals and trying to save their families, and the NPR interviewer found this guy at the bottom of a 30-foot well that he and his family had dug with their hands and with I think a bucket, and they were trying to get down there deep enough to get some water so they could save their remaining livestock. And the NPR interviewer was overwhelmed. I mean, you could hear he was in tears talking to this guy, and he said, "Is there anything I can do for you? How can I help you and your family?" And the guy paused for a moment and he said, "I could really use a shovel." and that was what he came up with, you know. And I thought, I have no problem. There's this guy at the bottom of a well in the middle of a drought in Africa. His livestock is dying. He doesn't know if his family's going to make it. He's no certainty whatsoever. And he thought his life could be better if he had a shovel. You know, and for me, that's just, it's perspective. That's and it immediately shifts my way of looking at the world from this sort of narrow, what I don't have, what the relative truths of just because of my narrow focus, what I don't see, to what I actually do see about the beauty of what I do have in my life. And how huge it really is, and what the potential, you know, how much I can contribute and how much I can interact, and it really opens things up. So sometimes it takes those what I call total perspective vortexes to give you that insight.
That's it. I learned that a long time ago as a child from my father. Growing up, kind of a standard American life, we would watch TV during dinner time, and one of my father's favorite programs was Kung Fu with David Carradine, you know, and Grasshopper. Yeah, and I remember one show that he's walking through the desert. He's kind of going across the plains, and he's thirsty, he's dirty, he's hungry. You can see the fatigue, and he comes to this ranch, and he comes up to a person in the ranch, and he asks him if he has work. And the ranch guy says, looking at him, says, "I'm not going to feed you and, you know, all these, you know, hand handlers and hand me outs." And Grasshopper says, "No, I asked if there was work." And the foreman kind of went, "Well, yeah, you can muck the stalls." Uh-huh. And so Grasshopper goes, and he goes to the barn, and he starts mucking the stalls. Well, the guy now feels bad because he's doing this work. So he brings him a glass of water. He brings him a little, you know, bit of food. It's that sense that I'm working. If I stop working, I despair.
Right. Mm-hmm.
If I stop acting, I despair. So what can I use? I can really use a shovel, because it makes my work a little bit easier, a little bit more fruitful, gives me a little more hope that I can go a little bit deeper, a little faster. It's that process.
Absolutely. It reminds me of the book Touching the Void. I can't remember. It's Joe. I don't remember his last name, but there's a movie, and it's a man who had an extraordinary, circumstances, a mountain climber, where he fell and ended up in a crevasse. And
yeah, he was climbing with a partner in South America, and I believe he had broken his legs, and the partner ended up having to
cut the rope
because he was being pulled off the mountain, and the guy actually fell in after already breaking his legs and having all sorts of pain I can't possibly imagine. Was then the rope was cut, and he ended up falling into a crevasse.
Deep into a crevasse.
Yep.
And, you know, one of his comments was, here I was, there's no way out of this. I have got broken limbs. But there was a relentless will to live. And what he said is that at some point you just have to keep making decisions. Even if they're bad ones, you just have to keep making decisions. And that's what kept him alive. And in the process, there was a lot of things that didn't work, but he found something that did.
And he ended up, what his solution was, he could not go up. There was no way he could climb back up. So what he did was he went down because that was the only way he could go. And he actually found a way out and literally crawled off of this mountain back to the campsite just, you know, moments before his friend had given up completely and was about to leave. And he saved his own life.
That's fabulous.
Yeah, and ultimately that's what we have to do. You know, we have people in our lives who can help us out and give us pointers and walk with us, but ultimately we have to want to save our own lives.
That's it. Yeah. When I became Russian Orthodox, I became Russian Orthodox when I was in college. I grew up Methodist, looking for a tangible relationship with Christ, and found that at a, you know, bookstore mission. As I was becoming Russian Orthodox, I was talking to the abbot of a monastery, and one of mine and a kind of group of friends, our question was, how do we know the will of God? Because that's always the question. We want to be, there's a sense within us that there's a direction, there's a path, there is health, there is wholeness, and we want to connect to that. And so I asked this abbot, how do we know the will of God? And he says, here in the monastery, one of the ways we support ourselves is the publishing of books. And lots of people send us manuscripts. How do I know the will of God? I read the manuscript. If it moved me, then I share it with somebody else. If it moves them, then I share it with a third person. If it moves them, then I look at publishing it. He says, what I've learned about knowing the will of God, what I've learned about hope, what I've learned about life itself, is that we have to keep taking a step. We take a step. If we find ourselves a few steps down the road, God blessed. And so my job next, take another step. If I take a step and I don't find myself anywhere, I have a choice. I can take a step in the same direction to make sure, or I can take a step in a different direction. The point is, take a step. And that has been kind of this life lesson for me, that not knowing what's in front of me, not knowing, you know, what is right, what is wrong, what is good, what is best, I keep taking steps. A friend of mine used to be an air traffic controller. And the motto in air traffic controlling was, make a decision. Make a movement. Make a choice. Make a direction. Because even if you make the wrong one, you can correct it.
Uh-huh.
But if you make no decision, no choice, no action, you're going to have two planes colliding into each other. And that's, yeah, is that piece. Take a step. We always have to take a step. If we find ourselves at a brick wall, okay, take a step in another direction, because the brick wall will always hurt every time we hit it. You know, but there's always a step.
I just always think it's very interesting to think about the nature of choice itself. We have free choice, a freely made choice. It's our gift. And how powerful. Powerful.
Yeah, there's a saying in the wisdom tradition of the scripture, of the Bible, that where there is much counsel, there is much wisdom. We have free choice, but we don't have all the answers. You know, and when I talk about spirituality versus religion, And I make those real broad. When I do this with a group, I get them to tell me first word that comes to mind. And I usually start with religion. And everything from hypocrisy to war to Bible to church to God comes up. And then I put spirituality on the board. And I say, okay, give me the first thing that comes to mind. And they say wellness or wholeness or meditation or connection or nature, these kind of things. And I look at that and I said, okay, so anybody here write the Bible? You know, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, anybody, you know, no, okay, none of us, you know, that's somebody else. Church, my house or somebody else's house? Well, it's God's house that we talk about. So, other. Well, wait, I do mental health. Anybody here today, God? And they never admit it. You know, it's when we talk about sense of religion, we're talking about other. something outside of ourselves. When we talk about spirituality, what we find is, who practices meditation? Who needs meditation? I do. Right? What about connection? That's important to me. Peace or serenity. These are important to me. This is self. That we took a look at this process of self versus other. Right? If I have a healthy spirituality, a healthy sense of myself, I will come to the questions in which I need to reach out to other to help me with. Right? It's the people who don't have that sense of spirituality who are always over here in other. And I ask people, I say, have you ever known a really religious person, a super religious person? You know everything about their church or their religion or their beliefs, but you know nothing about them as a person. And it's that balance that we need, that we talk about free choice. Free choice is mine. It is given to me. It's inherent within myself. But I have to know there are things that I know, and there's things that I don't know. And I know that need to know the difference. The Serenity Prayer talks about that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, let me know what I can change. Let me know what I can't change. And give me the wisdom to know the difference.
Mm-hmm.
It's that humility, really. Humility we often think of is humiliation. And it's so not the truth. That humility is simply knowing who I am and who I'm not. What my limits are and what my limits aren't. It's that sense of true, genuine self that gives me a sense of humility. I mean, Jesus himself says, learn of me, for I am meek and humble at heart. He knows who he is, and he knows who he's not. You know, and he makes it very clear. And that sense of identity, that sense of freedom, I can make real choices if I have real knowledge.
And I would say that the humility, it's the willingness to face everything and avoid nothing.
Yes.
It's really just to really face into what is the truth, and from that place, then you can act. And one thing I was thinking that you were, when you were speaking about the difference between religion and spirituality, I mean, I think religion can really offer the roadmap for people. There are practices inherent there that help people develop who they are as a person. So it's not to throw the whole thing. The idea, I hear a lot of people saying, "Oh, I'm spiritual, but I'm not religious." But what does that really mean? You need those practices in place to develop yourself as a person. Just if you want to run a marathon, you need to go out every day and you need to train. You need to run a little bit. You need to eat well and you need to sleep. So if you want to become a more spiritual person, you need to do practices that are going to help develop you in that way.
Exactly.
And I think all the more so in a culture that's, you know, largely materialistic. So it takes great effort. Really, I think that for someone to really cultivate spiritual depth in our culture, it takes really, you have to really want it. You really have to have a deep yearning and effort to, I would say, to actually cultivate a life that represents spiritual truth and spiritual aspirations. And I was going to say just about the humility, the qualities of humility. It's interesting because it actually points to strength, you know, and so it's the very, you know, when we're just thinking about men, okay, men, you know, we probably, you know, have a lot of conditioning towards arrogance than humility. And, you know, that's a broad generalization, but I think largely true. And so, but real strength, you know, for a man would be the capacity for humility, and for women as well. But anyway, the thing really that I'm finding in this conversation is that as we surrender, as we are willing to not already know,
yes,
and really, right, really let ourselves open up, life can reveal itself and offer tremendous capacities that wouldn't be seen otherwise.
That's
it.
Yeah. Right. You know, people will come to me as a chaplain, as a priest, not so much, but as a chaplain, they'll come to me and they'll say, you know, I've gotten away from my sense of religion. I've gotten away from my relationship with God in that way. What church should I go to? Well, I don't know what church they should go to. My question to them is, what questions do you have? And then they'll look at me and they'll say, well, what does that mean? You know, what do you mean? What questions? If you don't know what your questions are, how do you know that the church you're going to is the right one? Are they answering the questions that you have? Are they, you know, what path are you being led down? Is this place over here illumining that path? You know, we find a lot of, you know, people who, or I find a lot of people who, you know, will change churches or just not find the right church. They're not finding the right church, not because there aren't right churches out there for them, and they're not right congregations, there's not right communities, is they haven't found the right questions within themselves that they're trying to address, because entertainment can take me so far. And then I still come up against that, and maybe it's in the middle of the night, those deep, searching, unrelenting questions that I have of meaning and purpose, of ability and truth. You know, I have those questions that come up to me. You know, if I can know myself, it's that sense again. There's a wonderful saying in the Gospels that say, if you clean the inside of the cup, the outside will become clean. And I thought that was just, it's an odd saying in the sense that if I clean the inside of the cup, the outside will become clean. And it's that sense that if I see myself as that cup, and although pessimism and optimism, I like opportunists, see, as the pessimist and the optimist is arguing, the opportunist takes the glass of water and quenches their thirst.
That's great.
You know, but it's that sense that, you know, my glass is half full, glass is half empty. What's the purpose in having a glass? Uh-huh. And what's the purpose of the water in the glass?
Right.
You know? It's that process of having that integrity in that sense of knowing, if I'm thirsty, I don't care if my glass is half empty or half full. I'm just thankful that there's something in it.
Right.
So with that, we should probably talk about what we intended to talk about when we started the conversation, which was talking a little bit about, this is great because we really created a context in which to talk about this now, and I think it's a large context. So we want to talk about, the movement from, you know, from seasonal transitions and particularly what we're seeing this time of year, the movement from a really long winter that's not quite spring yet and has, you know, a good maybe 6 weeks to go before we end up there. And some of the things that you're seeing in maybe some of the clients that you work with and some of the ways that you try to help them deal with this transition, which we see as a really tough one.
Sure. You know, and it really has been a tough winter. And I've seen that across the board with both clients, clinicians, colleagues, friends, you know, my own family. This has been a long, hard winter. Not a lot of sunshine throughout the winter. It's been dark. It's been cloudy a lot. And so, and it's been very long and very, you know, snowy. And so it has drug on. I call it the winter woes because I like alliteration. You know, when we're in the midst of those winter woes, that's one thing because we're all in the midst of it. We have a sense of community. We can all complain about the weather. We can all complain about how long it is or how cold it is or unseasonable it is or whatever we can complain about. And we all agree. And that's great. And we have a sense, even in that sense of that slump, we have that ability of community. It's, you know, and just to talk about that sense there, that winter, you know, we understand winter. If we look around the world around us, we are blanketed. You know, we say with way too much snow at this point. You know, we are blanketed, and there's a sense of rest, renewal, regeneration. You know, these kind of things. We hear about these words talking about winter. It is dark. Why? Because we and the bears all should be hibernating to an extent.
Right. We need that time actually to go in. I mean, sometimes when people tell me, well, I think I have seasonal affective disorder, I say, maybe you're tired. maybe you need to rest. You know, maybe, yes. You know, December was really, usually for most people, it's kind of a blowout month of all this crazy activity. Yes. And it's a time where nature's doing nothing. I mean, it's really everything. You know, there's no sap in the trees. If you actually go outside at night in the middle of winter, it's stillness. Yes. It's, and we need that actually to go deep. And so when we don't do that in the winter and we try to push, and then come out into the spring as the energy's rising up, wait, there's nothing in the tank to come up.
That's right.
So it could, I think of it, a lot of people, it's just exhaustion.
But oftentimes, you know, we say, you go outside and nature's not doing anything. Nature is exceedingly active. Mm-hmm. In doing
nothing.
We think that if I'm doing nothing, I'm doing nothing.
Mm-hmm.
No, we talk about decisions. We talk about free will. You know, not making a choice is still making a choice.
Right.
Not doing something is activity.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the activity that we so need. We talk about, especially children, we see this in because we're, you know, interested in children, that we see a sense of expansion and contraction. And if kids will go out to play in recess and they have this great time, and then before they come into the room, they line up, they stand there, they're quiet in the lines, and this is when I was growing up, so who knows if they still do this. But there's that sense of contraction, they pull themselves in, they bring a sense of order, a sense of peace, a calm, and then they walk into the classroom and they're ready to learn. They're ready to take the next thing. It's the same thing in winter, that here, summer, sunlight, 24 hours of light of some sort, you know, we are active, we are going, we are, you know, all of our sap is being used. When we hit winter time, it is the time of contraction that we need to pull in to find a deep space within us and to begin to deal with that deep space and to begin to address it and to embrace it and to find that core, that center, that we can then, from there, coming into spring, as we are so hopeful for, we can then, from that place, come up. You know, that transition is the piece that concerns me. From winter into spring, there's a transition piece. In the wintertime, it's one thing to say, oh, I'm depressed, or I'm sad, or I'm low, or whatever I am, because we all are in that sense, and we can find community in that. As spring comes, the sunlight comes, the energy comes, the warmth comes, a lot of people will pick up, and they'll come out of that mood. But there's some of us who don't. And those are the people that concern me. Those are the people who I look out for. Those are the people who I want to pay attention to. Because oftentimes in that transition part, if I'm not coming up like with everybody else, I find myself lonely. I find myself isolated. I find myself asking myself, what's wrong with me? And maybe nothing will change. And we hit that hopelessness. Mm. And that hopelessness, we need community in that. Because if I'm not finding myself coming up, then I need to be able to look at what's going on with me. Where's my community to help draw that out?
That's great. And in the Chinese medicine, we also look at the quality of the winter dictates the quality of the spring. And so to the degree that we've been in alignment with what nature is calling for in a given season, it's going to dictate the quality of the season that follows.
In the winter, the motto is don't just do something, sit there.
Yes.
As opposed to don't just sit there, do something. And yeah it's really important for the stillness.
Winter embodies the quality of wisdom. And,
yes.
And spring is the quality of vision. And so isn't it interesting that wisdom and then moving
considering all what
vision,
we've been talking about.
Well, we've had just a wonderful conversation. It's been just terrific to have you on the show. How do folks get in touch with you if they want to follow up with your counseling?
They can call me. They go to your website or call me.
And we'll have Father Christopher's contact information on our Facebook page.
Wonderful. You can just go there and find that information. Or you can go to Father Christopher, frchristopher.org. And my information is there, too.
Great.
Wonderful.
Thank you very much for joining us on The Bridge to Everywhere.
Yeah,
have a great day, everyone.
Thank you, Father Christopher.
Thank
Bye.
You.
Thank you for joining us on The Bridge to Everywhere, broadcasting on KVRF 89.5 Big Cabbage Radio in Palmer, Alaska. Like us on Facebook at Bridge to Everywhere to access more information, links and resources from our guests and show topics.